A long winter.
Yeah.
So that I was at Hanford Mills 5 years almost, and maybe 2 months before I went to Canterbury. And going to New England, I was thinking, oh, this is an adventure. There's a history here that I don't know, and the property was very beautiful. 650 acres, I think nearly 24 structures, most not in very good shape, but from the 18th century, from the early 19th, and from the late 19th, and even a few from the early 20th century. So I thought, wow, this is a package. And two mill ponds. But I'm getting away from Hanford Mills, so shall we get it back to Hanford Mills?
Sure. How did you go about getting financial backing for the museum?
My first memories are that I don't know, you don't call it a conglomerate, but that coalition of places like the Board of Trustees, let's call it the Board of Trustees, and I couldn't meet their mortgage payments. So there was a big one coming up, and what was to be done? And the museum per se was just not off the ground yet. So my memory is that those elements from Rindy's, from Schoonmaker, and probably other county board of supervisors, and from Peter Borelli and Mr. Chase, I've forgotten his first name, begins with Sharon, Chevy, something, Mr. Chase, anyway. They asked Ken Kelso to come down in price. And I think they were able to do it by offering some tax savings to him, showing how there might be some tax savings by that thing. So that immediate crisis then, not really diffused, but as they say, kicked down the road. And we began to form a membership organization. We began to do proposals with the new documentation that we had from the architect and from the archaeologist. So we went to, with our proposals, to continue and to address some of the not startling, but the difficult situations that needed addressing. We went to the local foundations. So already we had good people, good professionals, having described the case. So we went, and of course we had Minor Wine Thomas and Sherwood and Borelli and Chase, who were all expert in preparing grant applications. So I'm thinking they trained me in the same way. And it went fast, and we got money because of good opinions and a cogent or coherent plan based on those opinions, and it seemed to be, you know, realistic given the social and economic environment of the mill and of those times, which remember, this was the bicentennial, and so there's a lot of enthusiasm about saving local history, preserving it. So all of those local foundations, which we're very lucky to have in this area, and they still give money, so that would be O'Connor Foundation and the Dewar Foundation from Oneonta. There was a foundation from Stanford, which is now referred to as the Broadhurst, but at that time I think it had another name, but maybe it was the same entity. So we were lucky to have, this area was lucky, not just the museum was lucky, but this area was lucky to have those, and still is fortunate, to have those entities giving millions of dollars a year to a place with a relatively small population base. And so... And I think this is an extraordinary situation, whereas all you have to do is demonstrate that you have a good plan prepared by knowledgeable people. And, like, I don't think we were competing with other museums at that point in their development in this area. So we were lucky, I think, in that sense. That was, we were certain, that gave us a certain privilege. So it was a, to use a term of the site, it was a perfect storm, but all positive, all of those things combining. I'm trying to remember other things. It was just, and it turned out we went to see a Hanford descendant. Because everybody, you know, knows those histories and knew of, and it turned out that he wanted to support the effort. He approved, and given his enthusiasm, and of course the history of the site, the name was changed from Old Mill Museum, to Hanford Mills, and. He also had his father's glass plate negative collection of late 19th and early 20th century views of the property and the village. So that was an incredible cache. C-A-C-H-E. And Mr. Hanford, Ralph, was generous. So it was... It was an exciting time to keep having the needs identified and then identify people who would assume the financial load, people, organizations, foundations. I'm trying to think if there are any other donors. Relations I had with the Hanfords and others made me really feel very positively about fundraising. And I still feel that way today and enjoy that that exercise. And in terms of my own studio, I use a variant of it for selling paintings. It's about cultivation. It's about listening. And asking at the right time, and not asking for too little. And then carrying through. Like, it's at this point, I'm running around the countryside delivering sales. Not that there are that many, but they were good sales. And so one to Philadelphia, one to New York, and one is local. But there's efforts, so... There's always support chores with fundraising that need to be done. Otherwise, you look sloppy, and a donor does not. You can't afford to show any signs of disorganization or lack of follow-through.
Could you talk a little bit how the mill transitioned from a working mill to a museum?
Well, first of all, by the time Ken Kelso had decided it should be saved, and he acted quickly enough, there had been no activity at the mill except grain milling grain, and maybe not even milling, maybe just it came in either on trucks or whatever, and then was dispersed to farmers. And then I think there was some kind of large gasoline engine running the sawmill. But again, these were not high volume things. So basically the era of the mill was over by the time they, at mid-20th century it was over, and they just continued as a depot, passing on goods rather than making goods. Is that enough answer, or okay?
So, what could you talk a little bit more about the research strategies you used in the early days to for interpretation?
I think, first of all, I've been out of the field for 20 years, so you could probably even be more articulate about it. But what I will say is that we were using those wonderful practices that were being established at places larger than us, like Hudson Mohawk Industrial Gateway, how you go about protecting an historic site and the materials while you go through that labor of collecting data and measuring eventually and just assessing it, what the cultural resource is. So I would just say that we were, which is I've always liked to do in museums, we tried to practice what our larger, like our big brothers and sisters were doing. We just imitated them. And, you know, they had their documents that were there for us to look at, and they shared. There was no, like, there was real sense of sharing and sharing intellectually. So it sounds a little rash to say, but we were using very up-to-date methodology because it was shared with us, and because the people we pulled in who had been recommended, you know, were in fact those top practitioners, whether it be in architectural preservation or industrial artifact and industrial site protection. And and then, of course, we had Cooperstown, the Cooperstown graduate program. I don't remember having a lot of interviews or meetings where you would think that would have been, you know, for how to do stuff. But I think there were, for example, about how to manage an archive. Because Minor Wine's not going to sit down there and tell me. So there must have been stuff about collections management and archive management coming out of the Cooperstown graduate program. Partly because that's, of course, what they're teaching, and partly because some of their students and their faculty would be contracting. But I don't have specific memories, partly because Minor Wine overshadows that. But I think about it, it wouldn't have been possible without that. So again, an incredible resource in this community.
What role did the board play in the development of the museum?
That's very interesting because they weren't as agile as I thought they should be. And not only I, Bruce Sherwood and Minor Wine Thomas, but because they hadn't had the experience of working or leading a cultural resource preservation and interpretation. So how did we address that? Because it was, and of course, Catskill Center would have been, you know, very familiar with those issues. Sherritt Chase was the president's name. And so I'm sure they had suggestions. I don't have a memory of a board retreat. I do have not specific memories, but people coming to talk to the board, people making a short appearance at a board meeting, whether it would be Rutsch or it would be the architect from Albany. I'm sorry, I don't know his name. He did wonderful work. It would be on the drawings. So there were people. Then another person appeared, who was Jane DeGrange, who was head of the... so this is all about how is the Hanford Mills getting its board together? So Jane DeGrange was head of the museums at Hartwick. And she came first as an interested neighboring institution. And then she came on the board. And she was a master of that. So that was, she would have probably, she would have been giving advice to everybody, that is, to board members individually, to the board as a group, and to me when I would go and sit with her and ask questions or... so that was again to have someone of her experience and interest. She also, I think, was probably instrumental in the fundraising part, especially where we began to think about individuals who might give other than through their own foundations. And because of her situation in Oneonta and her reputation, she was a member of a very prominent New York family, the Houghton family. And so she knew she had lived that probably from the time she was a youth, how people of means make their decisions about what to help and when to write a check and how to give their opinions and feedback. So that was that's very interesting. I hadn't thought of Jane in a long time. Trying to think of who else there was. So of course, like any organization, you're always trying to get that right person on. And that right person could be because of their intellectual resources, because of their financial resources, because of their connections. So but I do remember in the beginning it seemed slow. Partly because we were out of the chute so fast, thanks to Minor Wine and Bruce and Sherritt Chase and Peter Burley. I think it stunned people how quickly things began to happen like the water, and then what do you choose to do when everything needs done? Every roof needs it. You do the water wheel. You repair the water wheel. You repair the water impoundment system. So you've got some action. I mean, we documented it, and it was high on the list of resources to be protected. But it's also high on the list because people want to come and see something dramatic. So that effort also put us in touch with the community. There was a manufacturer in Sydney that did laminated beams and laminated. I'm sure not many people were making pulleys in the 1970s anymore, but they could make one. So, trying to think of how we were. And then what else we were doing, I remember rebuilding dry masonry walls. So we were lucky there was a, within the community was a great dry mason, drywall mason. And, almost to the thing we would number, take it apart, and put it back. I don't say it was perfect, but it was. There was an effort to imitate the rhythm, to put the stones back where they were, and to use the same technology, if you can call it technology. So, and I loved working with those craftsmen. Basically, the assignment was given by the pros from the architecture office and the archaeology office and coded within the Historic Structures Report. And I was just the go-between, looking. So it was nice communication challenge. How do you get in touch with these people? Like another person we got in touch with is, I'm trying to remember Mr. Howell's first name. Anyway, he was a millwright from England, and he had been working at a historic Tarrytown, and probably Ed Rutch was our contact. But he came as a, first to come look us over. And then came, I'm sure, as a paid contractor. So to have again, so then there's that skill level of handling the historic materials. That was very exciting to learn about. So I was in a lab and appreciated being there.
What was visitation like in the early days of the museum?
I think there was a burst, partly because of we made a point of getting out press releases, and partly it was the bicentennial, 1975. So, and I'm sure there were consortiums within the state setting about the business of letting the world know that these historical resources, or you call it historic resources, were there. I can't give you numbers, but I think there was a it was a promising growth in that period. And that didn't hold on, but not because the mill isn't interesting, it's because times changed. It was no longer bicentennial fever, and local history being as important as regional and national history. But so that was encouraging to all parties, especially funders, that we could say people are interested. And everybody was involved in that, on the board, and in the neighborhoods. You know, they were, I think there were a lot of referrals and a lot of shepherding people in the direction of that mill yard. And of course we got the classrooms there, which was an interesting exercise to take a class of what would have been, I'm not sure which classes they were, where they were junior high, probably not elementary school, so junior high. So that was also a way. I don't remember our public relations strategy. We did a couple of public events as a way to get, you know, the I used to think, and I think everybody thinks, if you can get editorial coverage, you don't have to buy commercial ads. So we would do, first of all, report what we're doing, and secondly, in create events. Like we had a thing called Artisans and Mechanics Day. And there was Old Engine Day and all of that. I think Ken had already established the Old Engine Day, Ken Kelso. But just doing those things that, and then you send off a press release. But as I say, I remember being involved and being interested. It didn't bore me. Nothing bored me there. It was just fast-paced and an academy to learn, which is why I think I wanted to go to, I have a MFA in studio work, but I think I'm, that's what I thought I need to learn more about museums. And I was interested in doing it.
What would the museum do with the school groups?
Basically, start them at the water wheel, and then probably in good time, a few of the machines were a few of the secondary processing machines. I don't think we were sawing. I don't think we were doing primary processing. But a couple of the secondary machines, like molding machines or a box making machine or something. I mean, did we have demonstrations going on? We could have, but I don't recall. So, I guess we wanted to show the youngsters, first of all, a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, that a part of the area's commercial business history had happened there, and that there was some interesting technology. So we wanted to introduce them to the concept of power production and power transfer. How do you get energy from one place to another? So we would talk about hydromechanical, and we'd also talk about hydroelectrical. And that seemed kind of magical, that the place that had, you know, done primary and secondary, mainly wood processing, although there was some grain processing earlier for feed and food, that they could be lighting the town. That was a nice concept, I think, to give to the young people, that this mill and this action of water power was producing lighting. And what else would we have been?